Hello, everyone, and welcome to this podcast that we've decided to record. I'm Dan Ryan, Senior Practice Consultant in the practice team, and I'll be talking with my colleague Lucy Giles, a practice consultant who has led on this particular guidance around counter-allegations. So, Lucy, why are we writing this guidance?
So we are basically, in a nutshell, writing it for two reasons, or two main reasons. The first is that part of the work that the practice team does is our public health approach. And that means that we get commissioned to go into areas, into local authorities, to look at their domestic abuse systems across the board. And that's with all risks. But we've been doing that for about 3 years now, and probably 4 years, sorry. Mm-hmm. It feels like it's been a long time. And in the last 2 years, or since COVID primarily, and that also might have an effect on this too, we have seen, in our observations, we've seen an increase in challenges around identifying the primary perpetrator. And we've seen that within the actual MARIC forum. And also seen that in our work at kind of looking at the systems, where it has felt, and from the case audits that we do, it has felt that there's been a lack of confidence and a lack of training and awareness in terms of kind of identifying who is the victim, who is the primary perpetrator. And with that, we've seen an increase in victims and perpetrators being identified as both being the perpetrator. And as we'll talk about a little bit later, we know that that is really, really rare in domestic abuse. So those are our observations as a team, as mm-hmm. practice consultants. But actually, coincidental to that, we have also been having lots of feedback from people in regions from each level, so on an operational basis, so kind of practitioners, people in specialist services, people in the police, people in partner agencies, excuse me, and also from a strategic level, so the people who actually kind of DA partnership boards that kind of bring us in to look at that, look at the systems, also saying that they're kind of having real challenges with identifying it. So there also feels, along with that, an anxiety amongst practitioners around kind of looking at those issues. And so I guess that another reason is that we want to ensure consistency in assessing and consistency in those thresholds, and especially in terms of referring to MARIC. Also writing it, just kind of, I suppose, bringing it back to basics. So for some people, this will be a return to kind of sort of looking at, I guess, reflecting on that knowledge around the dynamics of domestic abuse. For some people who aren't in the arena, it's not their core business every day, it will be something new. So it's actually kind of really looking at the dynamics of domestic abuse and mm-hmm. how this will help support the correct identification of the victim as well. And focusing on the MARIC as in this particular one, as we need to remember that the risk-led approach is key in keeping victims safer and identifying and assessing domestic abuse well. And also, just to say, this guidance, this podcast, we're kind of looking at it as sort of stage one. And then over the coming year, we'll be doing a kind of second stage, which will be broadening it out a bit more into kind of partner agency work and non-DA specialists. So although this guidance is for partner agencies, not just for specialist agencies, the second stage will be kind of much broader. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it does, yeah. Absolutely. And you touched on it just now, but in terms of who's this guidance actually for? This particular, in terms of this first one, okay. Who's the guidance for?
Okay, so primarily it is, because it is the risk-led approach, it's primarily for kind of MARIC representatives, including chairs, and obviously the representatives. I won't list them now, although I'd obviously love to, because I love MARIC. But on the website, it'll kind of give you the core agencies, so IDFA, police, and then the partner agencies. MARIC governance groups, so we always say a good operational MARIC can't function unless it's got a good strategic group, so it's definitely for those groups. Local domestic abuse partnership boards, and as I said, they were some of the people that have been giving us the feedback around counter-allegations. Local safeguarding boards, they have a duty, so that's adult and children, in terms of accountability of looking how their particular agencies and those with safeguarding statutory duties actually kind of work with counter allegations, because also it can be that challenge around same victim, same perpetrator work can be very, very prevalent with in particular kind of areas of safeguarding, such as child safeguarding. Mm-hmm. Domestic abuse services, and then all statutory and non-statutory services who have direct contact with victims, perpetrators. So whether it's a core bit of your business or a non-core function. So, you know, everyone.
Thank you. So, I mean, I suppose the question that I know that we've had from a lot of local areas and a lot of professionals and practitioners, and ultimately why we've kind of put this advice and guidance together, is why are we actually seeing a rise in counter allegations? I know that's a $64,000 question.
We'll be here till next Tuesday, Dan.
Absolutely, but in terms of briefly, why are we seeing a rise in counter allegations, do you think?
So I think that is really, really challenging, and it's some of the discussions that we've had in areas. So as people, when you read the guidance, you will see, I've just picked myself and also our amazing Scottish team who also kind of helped with this work, sort of pulled out a few ideas. So one of the ones which I'm not going to go into detail with, but I'm really happy to kind of have further discussions at some point. I think we can't get away from the fact that there is a myriad of reasons, but one of these reasons could be around kind of the media and societal effects on a broad level. So mm-hmm. in the past kind of 2-3 years, we have seen certain aspects of this in the media and conversations, etc., around counter allegations about perpetrators, victims in the public eye, and all of that. And I don't think we can completely remove that from the reality of what's going on, but that's not for discussion here. I think also, and this is I'm not saying this isn't a positive thing, it's an amazing thing, in that some ways Marics have been a victim of their own success. And we have seen the increase in that volume over the past few years. It might not necessarily always be high volume that's absolute high volume. There may be issues around that, but we have seen an increase in identification, which is fantastic, because, you know, that was always the goal of the work with Safe Lives, is to actually kind of, you know, move away from domestic abuse services and the police being the only people that are identifying, but actually all partner agencies are. So I think that has happened, which is great, but what has happened alongside that is that maybe people aren't feeling as confident in terms of being presented with the victim and perpetrator and being able to correctly assess which is a primary perpetrator. I think, you know, some of the other issues is that generally in society we've become more aware. So I think there's more of a focus on it now, which is really, really good. But I think with that, there can be kind of misinformation that actually the victim can also be the perpetrator, which we know is very rare. Mm-hmm. Also, there's been an increase in identification of LGBT Q+ cases, which is great, but dual identification can be really prevalent in that area. And we're not going to go in much into detail into this podcast, but read the guidance. And also, often counter allegations is talked about in terms of people who have dual needs, so maybe substance use needs and mental health needs, because it can be a way of perpetrators using power and control. And so I think, therefore, the increase of identification of those people can often result in professionals identifying them as both a victim and perpetrator, which is rarely the case that happens. And then also important to acknowledge other changes in the safeguarding field around children and young people, and the importance of ensuring appropriate risk assessment to differentiate between domestic abuse and parental alienation and parental conflict, which mm-hmm. is another something for another podcast, but yeah. Also that may be something down to the increase in misidentification of the correct perpetrator. That was a very long response, Dan.
It was, but really important, I think. And I suppose, so within the guidance, there's quite a big element and looking at the typologies of DA when we're talking about counter-allegation and identifying those. So who's doing what to who and the impact of that behaviour. And ultimately within it, we look at the most common typologies within counter-allegation, which is the violent resistance and intimate terrorism. And this feeds into acknowledging and resolving counter-allegations that can be really hard work, right, for a number of reasons. Do you just want to go into a little bit of that in terms of, you know?
Well, I think, as you said, I think it's one of the things that we are advocating for when our practice team go into areas to work with MARICs and partner agencies, is that we are definitely what we're not saying is that partner agencies need to spend thousands of pounds of having very in-depth training around domestic abuse. That's definitely not what we're saying. But probably what we see a lot and what we kind of hear from in terms of feedback is probably a need for partner agencies to have some basic knowledge around domestic abuse typologies. Because actually, if that was the case, and although we do see pockets of brilliant experience around the MARIC table, sometimes that's lacking, and actually that overall also can affect the kind of the running, the effectiveness of the MARIC. Whereas actually, if people had kind of some basic knowledge around it, it would help. So it definitely kind of feeds into that issue. So for example, perpetrators presenting as a victim. So maybe because they see themselves as the aggrieved party if they have experienced specific incidents, or because they are seeking to control and isolate their ex-partner by using the response of agencies, in particular with the criminal justice system, to further abuse. And individual agencies, partner agencies alone, may not have all the information about the relationship. So either parties' history of abusive behaviour or current risk, and therefore be unable to identify this behaviour. So in the guidance, like Dan says, we have kind of included not all the typologies, but certainly intimate terrorism and kind of violent resistance, because violent resistance is the biggest issue where you see victims wrongly being risk assessed as the perpetrator, and they're not. What they're using within the typology is defensive or retaliatory violence. So while these be subject to sanctions, so we're not sort of saying that someone shouldn't, you know, be held accountable, especially if that violence causes harm, including prosecution, the context of any violence or abuse must be understood to identify a primary aggressor or victim and manage risk to all parties appropriately. Then you've got perpetrators using coercive and controlling behaviour, which is really common. So victims of this type of abuse may have been coerced, knowingly or unknowingly, into taking part in behaviours that make them believe they are to blame for the abuse and or that is believe that it is mutual. So, for example, being forced to help the perpetrator self-harm or running from a perpetrator who then falls when in pursuit is a good example. And then obviously providing the best support to lesbian, gay, bisexual and trans LGBT Q plus victims, particularly where there are counter allegations. So provision for victims from these communities can be very limited, as we know. And generic services can find counter allegations challenging because of a lack of knowledge, experience or confidence in these cases, or other involving victims from diverse communities with specific needs. It's important to seek appropriate guidance. And I think, as we often say with our MARIC data, where we see that happening in the best way in terms of that identification and the kind of the I guess the most increased data of that happening well is usually in areas where they have got specialist LGBTQ plus services. So just to add to that.
Thanks. Okay. So also in terms of the typologies and things like that, if you would like more information of that and you're not exactly sure about those, you can always contact your local Advocacy Service that will have that information. Alternatively, you can also email our practice team's info box email. So it's info@safelives.org.uk for more information around that. So we know it's in the guidance, obviously, but should we go into a little bit about why it's so important to have clear understanding That the primary victim needs to be established as early as humanly possible.
It's really tempting, Dan, to not go into the detail of the guidance, but I'm completely trying to stop myself doing it. I was going to start talking about the detail and I'm not going to stop. Okay. So, yeah. So we, yeah, absolutely. So we have written, like Dan said, a series of bullet points around that. So if the victim is identified as the perpetrator, they may not access services, and because of this, will trust services less in the future. Their risk, and sorry, just to kind of, I guess if you think about that comment in isolation as well, that it's hard for victims who are identified as victims to actually access services for a myriad of reasons that we won't go into. So then if they are then at some point wrongly identified as the perpetrator, and like I say, we've seen this a lot recently, then it means that their trust in services and therefore their risk of being at serious harm is much higher. Their risk might increase further due to isolation. Care of their children may become a real issue for them in terms of care proceedings. They might be at increased risk of abuse from the primary perpetrator. So an example of that is that often victims use the violent resistance as a way of trying to escape. So it might be that they know what their perpetrator is going to do. They see a gap and then lash out because they know it's a way of them leaving with the children very, very quickly. But then if that doesn't work, they are then at massively increased risk of that retaliation from the actual primary perpetrator. They also might suffer psychological impact from not being believed. You know, that has a, as we know, there's lots of research and evidence to suggest that anyway. If the perpetrator is seen as the victim, this can also cause extraordinary harm. So their behaviour may feel vindicated based on the response from services believing them. And because of this, they will receive support from services which would be inappropriate and also dangerous. They could use being supported by the MARIC process and their victim status to further control and abuse the primary victim. And if you kind of think that coercive control is so prevalent in domestic abuse, that's a classic example of really extreme coercive control when they're using that ability of being a case as a victim at MARIC process as another way to control their victim. And maybe other members. And actually, they could be at risk of harm from the primary victim acting in self-defense. And actually, we've seen a few MARICs recently that have been absolutely excellent, because actually part of their action planning is to talk to the victim about whether they feel they are going to retaliate, because that's as a way of supporting the victim and also protecting them so they don't get themselves into a situation where they too may be kind of held for criminal justice sanctions. And then looking at a whole family response, which is what the public health approach is based on, the children will also be at increased risk of harm by the perpetrator. The children will not trust the support offered in future, and child protection strategies are less likely to help. And then from a MARIC point of view and the impact on agencies, counter-allegations can undermine this whole process, as I've already mentioned a few times. So valuable resources are wasted. And that's partly because a lot of time might be added to discussing whether they're the victim or the perpetrator, or kind of going around the houses, because there isn't a robust risk identification process. Initially, MARIC fails to achieve its aim, so supporting the wrong party through the MARIC process could create service-generated risks. Shared information at MARIC may not be relevant or proportionate, again, adding to a lack of robustness in the MARIC. And if the counter-allegation is not resolved and the wrong party is supported through the MARIC process, this could have implications for safe and legal information sharing.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. In terms of what we're talking about here, you can definitely understand the anxiety of practitioners and multi-agency forums and things like that with regards to counter-allegations. Yeah, and we've just spoken about, you know, the tip of the iceberg.
Totally. And also the fact that there has kind of two strands to it, which I think makes it even more challenging. So you've got, we're calling it counter-allegations because it's an easier title, but you've got two elements where it's about the actual risk assessment, risk identification in the first place. Okay, is this a victim? Is this a perpetrator? But then you've got the victims and perpetrators who are then making a counter-allegation against each other. at some point in that process. So they're kind of quite nuanced differences, but that makes it extra challenging.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so with this in mind, should we talk a bit about assessing counter-allegations? Because I see that within pages 4, 13 and 14 of the advice and guidance document, there is a process checklist, as well as checklist within that. And that would be quite good just to touch on those. Obviously, not too much detail, but just touch on those for us.
Yeah. So this is kind of put together and is based on a really, really powerful domestic abuse counter-allegation checklist by Damien Carnell. We've added it into the guidance, and thank you to Drive that, to Viv. So it might be that the person referred to you as the perpetrator is not the perpetrator. And if there is a point in the assessment that you feel there is a good reason to believe this person to be the survivor who is actually resisting or retaliating, as we said, that's kind of one of the domestic abuse typologies, you can then complete the Safe Life Dash RIC instead. Or if you feel that you're presented with both parties and it's hard to identify which person is the primary perpetrator, then do them both. So do the Safe Lives Dash RIC and then do the counter allegations checklist. So it's a checklist as opposed to a risk identification tool, but it's also a kind of process checklist that is really, really helpful. And it's helpful to be familiar with this checklist and also to, if you can kind of attend sort of training around counter allegations, which Safe Lives is probably going to implement at some point as well. So, if you kind of take a look at that with the guidance, so it'll give you kind of a series of common survivor characteristics and also kind of common perpetrator characteristics as well to go through, and then kind of looking at the profile of the assessee, looking at kind of behavior around the non-retaliating survivor and the retaliating survivor. So it helps you with the checklist break down the behavior of both parties if it's unclear as to who the perpetrator is, and it also kind of looks at their behavior in a silo way, which we don't normally talk about that in terms of risk identification and MARAP, because there's people who've seen me working in their areas, and we'll talk about actually don't look at stuff in silos. It's important to look at the whole picture. But actually, we're using this checklist. You're looking to see if maybe the violence or the violent incident happened, but is in complete isolation and has only been perpetrated once, because that means then you need to look at the whole picture to see actually if that's only one piece of violent behavior, is that person in fact the victim and has had a one-off sort of incidents and violence against the perpetrator. Does that make sense?
It does.
That sounds quite
make sense. In terms of the silo working as well, that's really interesting. Yes, because of course you do this in isolation.
Yeah.
But in terms of that, you also have the multi-agency approach there as well, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And always, always seek advice and support from your multi-agency partners as well. And especially in MARAC, we always say a MARAC is a process. It also shouldn't be a group of experts sitting around a table. It should be a team sitting around the table that you kind of work sort of together, supporting each other along the whole kind of way that the process happening. Okay, right. Is there anything else, Dan, you would like to
ask? I think there's going to be a part two of this.
Yes.
Which looks at this in a bit more detail in terms of the multi-agency approach elements as well that we touched on right at the end. I'd just like to say thank you to Lucy and also Sarah and Viv who put this together. It's fantastic. Thank you very much. Also, anything you've heard today, please get in touch if you're not sure about anything on the our practice team information email inbox, which is info@safelives.org.uk. And thanks for listening.
Thank you.